supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. In the wake of the Florida school shooting massacre that claimed 17 lives, Pennsylvania U.S. Senator Pat Toomey is renewing his push for more restrictions pertaining to gun sales and ownership. And toward that end, he had audience today with President Donald Trump at the White House. Let's review what took place with WHYY Harrisburg contact Katie Meyer. Katie, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
And for context, why don't we go back a few years to Toomey's bill that he co-sponsored with West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin. What were the features of that measure?
Sure. So this was in the wake of the Sandy Hook shooting, and it would have expanded background checks for firearm purchases to include sales online and at gun shows. And those are two of the most prominent places where people can currently buy a gun and, you know, not get a background check. And so the bill came very, very close to passing. It was like six votes short, but it did not pass. And so a similar version, Toomey said he may tweak it, but didn't say exactly how he would do so, or if he doesn't even know how he would do so yet. A similar version is being pushed again in the wake of this new massive shooting.
And as such, did he feel that President Donald Trump is perhaps more receptive to considering those measures?
The president certainly did seem receptive to that measure, to those measures, and Toomey also said that you know, a lot of his colleagues, Republican colleagues, seemed more receptive to it as well. You know, saying times have changed, this stuff keeps happening. Worth noting, though, President Trump kind of took it a step farther. He said he does support the expanded background checks, but then he also asked Senator Toomey if he would put into the bill a measure to raise the age to buy guns. And Toomey said no, he does not support raising the age from 18 to 21. And to that, Trump told Toomey that was because he was afraid of the NRA, that Toomey's afraid of the NRA. So it was interesting tonally from the president today.
I'm not sure Toomey's afraid of the NRA. It's been quite a while since the NRA withdrew their support of him.
Well, right.
Why does Toomey substantiate not raising the age from 18 to 21?
Well, he says it's a Second Amendment issue. We asked him about this on the conference call today. He said he's not sure the benefits of doing that outweigh the costs, that being people can't buy them at a younger age anymore. He also noted, the minimum age for buying handguns is already 21. And, you know, when asked why that discrepancy, Toomey said that he thinks handguns are more commonly used in crimes. And he did say this, there's a quote from him, he said, "I think reasonable people can disagree about this. I don't think the correct age is handed down by Moses." So whether or not that's a, you know, an admission that maybe we can talk about the age, it's kind of unclear. But it certainly seems there may be a conversation about that if Trump sticks on this line.
Thanks, Katie.
Thank you.
WHYY's Katie Meyer live from Harrisburg. In other news today, congressional candidates typically know where their districts will be months or years before an election, but this year in Pennsylvania has been anything but predictable. The Delaware County Congressional District held for the past 8 years by Republican Representative Pat Meehan is now the scene of an increasingly chaotic election season. WHYY's Dave Davies reports that new Democrats are entering the race at a steady clip, and Republicans are scrambling to find a candidate they can bank on.
Consider the plight of Delaware County Republican Chairman Andy Riley. 2 months ago, he had a well-liked incumbent poised to seek re-election. Then Meehan became embroiled in a sexual harassment scandal, and the state Supreme Court realigned the district so it's more Democrat-friendly. Now Riley wants to pick from a half dozen Republican hopefuls and get the party behind that choice, but
we're unable at this point to endorse a candidate because we don't know where the district lies.
Riley's hoping Republican lawyers can convince the court to restore the district's old boundaries. Meanwhile, the new district is attracting new Democratic candidates. One is Mary Ellen Balchunas, who twice won the Democratic nomination for the seat in the past. She says she's carried the party's banner in some tough battles and is now ready to compete with newcomers seizing on the issues of the day.
I didn't just wake up after the election. I mean, I've been interested in gun safety since 2000. After Columbine, I was out protesting and I'm part of Moms Demand Action. So I don't just talk the talk. I've walked the walk.
Another new entrant is former Swarthmore School Board member Mary Gay Scanlon, an attorney who's worked on social issues for many years, including gun control after the Columbine shootings. She says the state needs to finally add a woman to its congressional delegation.
I do think it's a woman's year. I am one of the few women in the race who's actually run for or served in public office already.
Former Philadelphia Deputy Mayor Rich Laser is expected to announce his candidacy for the seat soon. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Uncertainty over district boundaries is causing confusion all over the state. And as Keystone Crossroads' Emily Previty reports, candidates are scrambling.
My name is Laura Quick. I am a Teamster running for Congress.
Democrat Laura Quick is with two campaign staffers at a Panera Bread not too far from her home in Palmyra, Lebanon County.
Since I've been organizing in a different area.
At this point in the campaign cycle, Quick normally would be further along with endorsements, volunteers, contributions, and signatures for her nominating petition.
I'm in Carbon, Columbia, half of Luzerne, Montour.
But as Quick and other candidates were poised to gear up their campaigns, many were still adjusting to how the boundary lines changed under the new congressional map. The Democratic majority state Supreme Court had published it just a few days prior, and Republican state lawmakers were in the midst of filing multiple legal challenges, hoping to reverse the ruling.
You know, it's a wild, wild west a little bit with these new districts.
Candidate responses have been all over the place. Dauphin County Commissioner Mike Pries planned to run when he lived in a district with an open seat, but quit after being drawn into a new Capital Region district with fellow Republican Scott Perry, an incumbent seeking a fourth term. Others are staying the course.
That old saying, may you live in interesting times, this last month or so has been very interesting and it has not been fun.
State Representative Stephen Bloom, who lives just outside Carlisle in Cumberland County, is seeking the Republican nomination in a new district that goes from Gettysburg to Johnstown.
Whether the new map stands or the new map gets thrown out and the old map is brought back, either of those two scenarios actually for my campaign presents a reasonably good scenario, but it's causing a lot of chaos and trouble for candidates across the state and I think confusing the voters.
Former Revenue Secretary Dan Muser, a Luzerne County Republican, and Pittsburgh Democrat Connor Lamb might run in districts where they don't live. Meanwhile, Clinton County Democrat Wade Jodin says he plans to move in order to keep running. He's hoping to oust Center County Republican Glenn Thompson, who's been in office more than a decade. Here's Thompson.
The odds of a Democrat winning this congressional district, the way the state Supreme Court justices have had it drawn, it would be 0.26 of 1%.
Some of the changes on the map have launched campaigns from scratch. State Rep. Madeline Dean went from running for lieutenant governor to seeking the Democratic nomination in a new district comprised mainly of Montgomery County. In general, analysts say the court's map has improved Democrats' chances. Incumbent Republican Ryan Costello is considered particularly vulnerable. Chester County Democrat Chrissy Houlihan is hoping for the chance to face him.
Sort of like a coming together of a community that's always been together. We always have identified as being from either Chester County or kind of Lower Berks or whatever, and we're finally actually unified.
Some Republicans who consider themselves anti-establishment also believe they now have a better shot of winning because they think the new map diminishes the advantage orchestrated by the Republican machine. Laura Quick, meanwhile, says her situation shows new opportunities aren't consistent across the entire map.
It's just so much more heavily Republican, and I don't have a good sense of it yet. Until I get a better sense, I really feel I'm working at a disadvantage in the new one.
One consistency that came up in talking to Republicans and Democrats is that they'll restart canvassing and seeking signatures close to their hometown and work out into the district from there. Even for candidates who see their chances as potentially better under the new map, the logistics of living with it have proven challenging. Again, Republican Stephen Bloom.
I'm scrambling, literally, you know, today, making calls, sending texts, researching, trying to figure out who's where and who can I get to help me in these other counties. So it's rather overwhelming, especially logistically. And then, of course, it's going to be a 10-week sprint to election day.
Sprint, scramble, probably both. Emily Previty, Keystone Crossroads.
In the aftermath of the Parkland, Florida massacre 2 weeks ago today that claimed the lives of 17 students and teachers at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, students, Parents and staff in our region are voicing concerns about security in their schools. Cherry Hill East High School history teacher Timothy Locke was suspended after he suggested to his students last Thursday that their school was potentially vulnerable to attack. The fallout from that action has led to protests by students, who in turn were threatened by school administrators, all leading up to a contentious Board of Education meeting last night. In attendance there was Cherry Hill Mayor Chuck Kahn, who joins me now. Mayor Kahn, thanks for making time for us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you for having me.
What were some of the key takeaways in listening to students and parents?
They were extremely, the children in particular, young adults, I should say, extremely articulate. I think that really the main message that I heard was that they do not feel safe. And that was my greatest concern. And whether we've done measures or whether the Board of Ed has taken measures or not, they just don't feel safe. So it is our responsibility to do whatever we can to make them feel safe every single day.
Part of their contention was that even their administrators didn't really have a grasp of how safe or not the school was. Let's not get into casting blame, but what solutions did you offer?
We have a very important meeting on Friday morning, this Friday morning, with representatives from the Board of Ed and the police district and elected officials, just to talk about this very topic and to see what we can do to make sure that we take the necessary steps. And it's a multi-pronged approach. We know that. It doesn't happen overnight, but we'll make sure that it happens quickly, and the things that we can do, we'll implement as soon as we can.
So you just cited your police chief, and indeed William Monahan recommends that officers be deployed in the district's schools. Can that happen rather quickly, if you or others are in favor of it?
The police chief has recommended that. He has been an advocate of arming campus police officers that are trained and certified to handle weapons and to supplement them with Cherry Hill Police Force. We agree with that, we being myself and our township council. So could it happen? That is really a decision for the Board of Ed. I made that clear last night to the residents and to the Board of Ed that it is a decision that myself and council support. We hope that the Board of Ed would support that as well. I believe that what I heard last night is that the overwhelming majority of the parents are asking for the same security as well.
And we have to enlarge beyond Cherry Hill East. I believe there are some 11,000 district students. And to safeguard all of the schools with perhaps armed officers, how will that expense be incurred and who will pay for it?
Well, I am clearly not talking about Cherry Hill East. I represent all of the residents, as does the Board of Education. We are talking about looking at all of the schools, starting with the high schools and the middle schools. And I'm sure you realize now that the schools presently have security officers today. So our plan would be to replace those security officers today or to supplement those that can carry weapons with what the New Jersey legislation has passed as what we call SLEO 3s, which are retired police officers that are certified to handle weapons. And we would then have those officers in our high schools, our middle schools, and a presence in all of our elementary schools. We think all of the schools need to be protected.
Is there much appetite among your constituents for the proposal to arm some teachers in schools?
I really don't think so at all from those that I've spoken to. Certainly some of the teachers that I've spoken to, I don't think that's the role of the teacher, and I think that puts more danger and more people in harm's way. And I would certainly not ask a teacher who is there to educate our children to make that decision and to have to shoot somebody. So I really would not advocate for that. That's my personal opinion.
Hindsight is 20/20, but perhaps the means by which the history teacher, Timothy Locke, who by most measures was highly regarded by students year after year, perhaps that situation was handled in a, shall we say, clumsy manner.
You know, that is something that I really cannot comment on. I don't know Mr. Locke. I don't know his reputation. What I know is what I heard from the parents and from the children. Everybody spoke highly of him, but like most situations, there's always two or three sides to every story. That's for the Board of Ed to make a determination on, and I'm sure they'll do a proper investigation.
Mayor Khan, thank you so much for taking time to explain the situation in your municipality.
Thank you for taking the time to ask.
Cherry Hill Mayor Chuck Khan on Newsworks Tonight. Finally this evening, we have a tale from the Civil War with a Philadelphia twist. From Gimlet Media's Uncivil podcast, hosts Jack Hitt and Chinjerai Kumanika spoke with it about with historian Ben Tarnoff. In 1862, Sam Upham had a stationery shop and newsstand on Chestnut Street, and one day he notices the Inquirer is selling especially well. The reason? A reproduction of the brand-new Confederate $5 bill on the front page. Upham prints replicas of the $5 note and sells them for a penny as souvenirs, calling them mementos of the rebellion. Soon, they're selling so fast, something else must be going on. Chinjerai Kumanika picks up the story.
Upham figured out that people weren't just buying them as souvenirs. Upham's name and address were at the bottom of these bills, but he learned that people were clipping that part off and then spending his souvenirs as real Confederate money. And it was easy to pass them off this way, because the real Confederate bills were junk. All the good engravers were in the North, and so was the good paper to print it on. So the Confederacy had to resort to newsprint to print their money on. Confederate dollars were even called graybacks, because they smudged so easily, and they looked dirty.
And the fact that Confederate currency was so crappy made Upham's bills very convenient for customers who could buy them up North and spend them down South. People like cotton smugglers. See, smuggling cotton was big business during the Civil War. To hurt the South's economy, the North's official policy was to stop buying their cotton. But like the rest of the modern world, the North was deeply dependent on the cheap cotton that slavery produced. So Northern mill owners found a way to get their cotton through smugglers who bought bales of it with Upham's fake bills. Ben Tarnoff.
So if you can sneak into the South with Upham's counterfeits, buy some cotton, and then sneak back into the North, you can sell it for an enormous profit, particularly if it's just counterfeit notes that you paid with to begin with.
So to make it easier for cotton smugglers, Upham makes it possible to buy huge quantities of his fake money all at once.
He starts selling them in stacks. You can get 100 for 18 cents.
And then he made it so that his customers didn't even have to come to the store to buy his bills.
He does fulfill a lot of these orders through the U.S. Post, which is even better for a cotton smuggler, because if you're in Memphis, you don't have to travel to Philadelphia to get these notes. And they'll show up in your mailbox in a week or so, which is really convenient and, of course, unprecedented in the history of counterfeiting.
That's right. Samuel Upham was the Amazon.com of fake money. Upham had started out printing $5 Confederate bills, but later he started printing 10s and 20s too. Then he got audacious and started counterfeiting $100 Confederate bills. Here's his descendant, James Foster.
There must have been a sort of a second light bulb moment there where, like, given the production was ramping up and the type of people who were coming in, he'd have to know at some point that he had kind of crossed a certain line into something else, you know?
And before long, Upham's counterfeits started to appeal to battalions of customers, literally. Ben Tarnoff.
I think very early on, Union soldiers must have heard about Upham's operation. All of those Union soldiers who were coming through the rail depot in Philadelphia on their way to the front would have gone to Upham's to buy counterfeits, which then they'll use when they're in the South to purchase supplies from Southern civilians.
With cotton smugglers and Union soldiers buying his money up North and spending it in the South, Upham had now gone from souvenir salesman to straight-up counterfeiter. And as the months passed, he watched waves of soldiers march off to war, armed with his bills. The small-time shopkeeper was now printing millions of counterfeit bills. Here's James Foster again.
You know, what started out as a kind of a novelty act turned into a kind of subversive operation of sorts.
Confederate officials knew that this constant flow of fake money was potentially disastrous for the Southern economy. If too much money gets printed, the value of all the dollars in circulation goes down. So that bottle of sarsaparilla you bought 1 week could cost twice as much the next. And the newspapers down south sounded the alarm.
The Lynchburg Virginian cautions the people of the South against counterfeit Confederate notes being scattered broadcast by the Yankee thieves who are now devastating Virginia.
And these newspapers knew exactly who to blame for this problem.
The swindle before us is an engraved note, and so like the original that it can only be detected by the words in very small print underneath the borderline. Facsimile by S.C. Upham, Chestnut Street, Philadelphia.
Down south, Upham became known as the Yankee Scoundrel.
Yankee Scoundrel. I would hope he would wear that as a kind of badge of honor. You know, he might have welcomed it with a kind of, mischievous glee, embracing it.
And it's hard to know why Samuel Upham did what he did. Publicly, he always said he was just a guy who sold souvenirs. But even his descendants struggle with how to think about him now.
I'd love to romanticize it and say that, oh, he was a badass patriot who was gleefully undermining the South's economy with his pretty paper bills. But I'm sure other things also factor in as well. Like, for one thing, he was also making money the whole time he was doing it. You know, so there is obviously a financial aspect and perhaps a financial motivation too, as well as some patriotism and badassery.
Inflation was already tearing through the Southern economy. The Confederacy had been printing lots of money to finance the war effort, and Upham's counterfeits were making the inflation problem worse. Competition sprang up from other counterfeiters, driving down the price of the fakes and eventually forcing Upham out of business. You can find the full story of Sam Upham at Gimlet Media's Uncivil podcast. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.